Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It offers flexible spending capacity that adapts to your business. You can also earn up to $395 in annual statement credits on eligible purchases at select business merchants. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones. From powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY. A big idea that inspired the world to invest differently. And still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
My mission is simple, to make you money. I'm here to level the playing field for all investors. There's always a bull market somewhere, and I promise to help you find it. Mad Money starts now.
Hey, I'm Cramer. Welcome to a special edition, a West Coast edition of Mad Money. Welcome to Cramerica. Other people want to make friends? Man, I'm just trying to save you some money. My job is not just to entertain, but to educate, to teach you, and to try to put this market in context, because I know it's awful. Call me at 1-800-743-CNBC or tweet me at Jim Cramer. On a day like today, where the Dow plunged 638 points. S&P plummeted 2.38%. NASDAQ nosedived 2.75%. All I can say is, come on, give us a reason why you're selling, will you? Did you borrow too much money and the margin butchers are booting you out to get the cash? Are you a hedge fund manager whose investors want their money back, a redemption? Maybe you just can't take it anymore, and that's why you're selling. I always say people sell stocks for many reasons, but the only reason they buy is to make money. Right now, the former camp is a lot more powerful than the latter.
Sell, buy.
Now, after spending all week talking to the very same kinds of companies that led this horrendous market down, I got some good news and some bad news. Actually, though, it's the same news. The average Silicon Valley CEO I speak to, and I've probably spoken to 24 this week, when asked about their plummeting stocks, say simply, why are you judging us on a quarter when we have such a positive long-term story? Now, that is a true statement. But the problem is the owners aren't patient. And if they keep buying on the way down, unless they are super rich, they will run out of money. It's easy for millionaire CEOs to talk about thinking long term. Regular investors can't afford to wait for the business to turn, though. In the end, people take the losses personally, or in many cases, they don't take the losses because they're hoping for the stocks to make a comeback. Unfortunately, that rarely happens, people. And even if it does, it probably takes much longer than you can stand. So what's the solution to this problem? Oh, but I got lose sleep every night about this because I know how awful this market is. I wish I had an easy solution. But some days nothing works. Days like today, where even the oils went down. Now, we had themeless trading. Some stocks were up, most stocks were down, with the winners almost totally random and arbitrary today. What is going on? I think we're in a period of the great readjustment, where investors are frantically trying to figure out what to pay for companies that aren't making that much money now, but may make a lot of money in the future. At the same time, they try to revalue companies that are making money now, but may make less money in the future because rates keep rising. Then, of course, there are the consistent companies that can make good money no matter what. But finding those is a treasure hunt game, and there's not enough treasure out there. And when you find it, the stocks are usually too expensive. For most of the last 12 years, we haven't had to navigate this kind of river. We've had a straight run, smooth run to higher and higher prices. It was placid. It was seamless. It was sweet. Most important, it was easy. Now we're plunging along class 5 rapids, and we're glad we have helmets because people falling out of the raft, bouncing off rocks, holding on for dear life, you need a helmet. Like Class 5 Rapids, you don't know what's going to throw you. It's just not possible to see. So I want to dramatize for effect by just looking at one sector. I could have picked 20 of them. I want you to take a look at the stock Block. That's the company formerly known as Square. Until recently, the stock was a beautiful market darling that could do no wrong, including the purchase of a giant buy now, pay later company. And that was called Afterpay. That was an announced $29 billion deal last August. The actual purchase price was lower because it was an all-stock deal and Block shares collapsed between when the deal was announced and when it was closed. But at the time it was announced, it was hailed as like just a brilliant deal. And the stock roared just on the possibility of an acquisition in that red-hot buy now, pay later area. So this thing went from $200 last June to above $280 in August. We were told younger people love the concept of buy now, pay later, so we should buy the stock. But as interest rates rise, we're now seeing the cracks in that credit edifice. You know the cliche joke, buy now, pay never. The old Square had been very adept at letting small businesses borrow money against the receipts because Square itself was processing those transactions. But buy now, pay later doesn't have that kind of collateral. Next thing you know, the market turns on the fintech stocks and Block takes a beating. If this thing was down another 9% today for 76, it's down 76 bucks. So much for a brilliant acquisition. But I got really bad news for you. Nothing happened to Block today. Nothing. And it went down that much. Affirm. Another buy now, pay later operation. We just had on Max Levchin, the CEO. It's seen its stock go from 168 at the peak last November to $21 and change here, down another 9% today. Not long ago, CEO Max told us that his default rate's incredibly low. He said he can repackage those loans and sell them with ease. The Wall Street Journal just reported that 3.7% of a firm's loans are at least 30 days overdue, up from only 1.4% a year ago. Now, that's freaking people out for good reason, even as though it's not necessarily all that different from the reassurance Max gave us. But the market is saying, so what? There's credit risk? I didn't think there was credit risk. Get me the hell out of this thing. Last fall, we spoke to Dan Shulman, the CEO of PayPal. When he came to New York, his stock had fallen from the 180s down from the 300s a few months before. He seemed exasperated that stocks like Affirm and Square, their stocks were doing much better than him. So what did he do? He claimed proudly that PayPal was the biggest player in buy now, pay later. Well, Shulman sure got his wish, but it's a monkey's paw situation because Wall Street now hates buy now, pay later. One reason PayPal stock has plunged another $100 since that interview. Now, I don't want to pick on any one particular group because so many things are crumbling here. I'm just trying to show you how when you buy stocks of companies that are expensive with no dividend protection, you know, low interest rate environment, you're going to keep getting blasted until the Fed is finished raising rates. Probably not anytime soon. Tightening cycle just started. The market is littered with stocks like this. We have Uber on tonight. Oh, that's a great company. I know you use it all the time. Stock's been cut in half just in the last year. Why? A year ago, it wouldn't be up on the same metrics. This stock would have doubled. Now it's cut in half. A year ago, it was in style in the Wall Street fashion show, and now it's not. I think it will be the big winner in the group. But do you have enough money to get to that promised land where it wins? You have to if you're going to own it. Two of the companies out here that are hailed as huge success stories, Airbnb, love it, DoorDash, use it. They plummeted 6.5% and 7% today, respectively. Why? No reason at all. They just happen to be growth stocks that have nothing to fall back on. No dividends, no buybacks, just a chance to make big money someday in the future. Winning businesses. But losing stocks.
Sell, 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 sell.
No one who owns these stocks seems to care about the out years now. It's much easier to believe the bright future when you got a bright present. And we don't have that anymore. So what's the end game here? As I've said over and over again, you want to own companies that make real things, do real stuff, turn a profit in the process with relatively cheap stocks and good dividends buybacks. That group is held up much better. It's losing money, but it's held up. Believe me, I know there are some terrific tech companies that fit those parameters. They're all down big today. But there are two major differences. One is that many of the stocks I own for the CNBC Investing Club have a defined downside because of that dividend and their lack of sensitivity to interest rates. Oh, sure, they can overshoot it. But we know they're going to get through. The other reason, they're mature companies that have gotten through recessions before and come out the other side even stronger. They've got the culture for it. They're seasoned. Many of the companies that have come public in the last few years have never seen anything like this. And you know what? It shows. If your stock doesn't have these stalwart qualifications, there's a huge problem. I cannot tell you where the share price stops. I don't know. There seems to be no companies willing to acquire most of the disappointers because the market will look askance at the acquirer. That means there's not a lot of value yet. If interest rates stop going up, you could be fine. But do you really want to be own share, say, in a company that's hostage to the slings and arrows of the bond market at the beginning of a tightening cycle? Bottom line, there are hundreds. hundreds of stocks that fit the depiction of what I like. But there are thousands of stocks that fit the depiction of what I don't like. If you own the tangible stocks I've been highlighting, you have an opportunity to buy more into weakness. If you're stuck with the conceptual stocks that I've warned you away from, well, you have a crisis. You know which I prefer. Let's go to Ryan in Texas. Ryan.
Jim, big fan, man. Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you. Thank you for calling in.
Questions about Sentinel One. I know you've had Tomer on the show a couple times, and then they got big competitors like CrowdStrike, and I know you've talked to George a few times. Give me your take on Sentinel One. Is it ever going to be a CrowdStrike type stock?
Look, thank you for the question. Sentinel One, it's a good company, but it's up against CrowdStrike and it's up against Palo Alto Networks. Those are really, really great companies with a good panoply of businesses. And that just may be too tough right now. It just may be too tough. All right, listen, I know this was a really tough day, okay? And I'm trying to be plaintive. I'm trying not to fly off the handle. But you've got to know that if you own tangible stocks, you do have an opportunity to buy more into weakness and have more chance of getting that money back. If you have the conceptual stocks, on the other hand, then I think you are indeed in some trouble. And I'm not sure when that trouble ends. On Mad Money Tonight, is innovation alive and well in the Bay Area, and what is it worth? I'm getting a read on e-commerce trends and transformative tech from a company in the know. I've got the CEO of creative powerhouse Adobe. Then after announcing a strategic partnership with self-driving company Waymo, I'm sitting down with the CEO of Uber to talk about innovation and the future for the rideshare company, which I think is going to be the big winner. And Splunk, it's on a mission to manage big data, but can it manage all that Wall Street's throwing at the tech cohort that I just described? I'm going to talk to the company's top brass. So stay with Cramer, coming to you from San Francisco.
Don't miss a second of Mad Money. Follow at Jim Cramer on Twitter. Have a question? Tweet Cramer. Hashtag Mad Tweets. Send Jim an email to madmoney@cnbc.com or give us a call at 1-800-743-CNBC. Miss something? Head to madmoney.cnbc.com.
When you're hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search. Match. With Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging to connect with candidates faster. Plus, 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed. Listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Mad Money. Just go to Indeed.com/Mad Money right now and support this show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/Mad Money. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
To find value in a Silicon sector severed from success, investors will have to get creative. Fresh off earnings, what picture does Adobe's quarter paint for your portfolio?
After 7 months of carnage, what do I do with the better-run software stories? Well, like Adobe. This digital media and e-commerce facilitator is a major player in the digitization game. But unlike so many others, Adobe's an established company with real earnings and maybe even a justifiable valuation. Right now, the company's in its quiet period because it reports next Thursday. But while we're out here in the Bay Area, I wanted to check in with them. They're that good. This feels like a very tricky environment for the digitizers, even the pros. Earlier today, we got a chance to speak to Shantanu Narayen. And Shantanu is the chairman and CEO of Adobe. And I want you to look at this because this is one of those that does make something and does produce great revenue, great earnings. Shantanu, I got to tell you, you could be a breath of fresh air. A lot of people have been saying, there's not much happening out here. You are a person of innovation and creativity. Please give me some hope that there are new things that are occurring right now at Adobe that we will soon learn about that will really excite us.
Well, Jim, first, it's great to be back on the show, and it's great to be back in person.
Yeah,
I mean, how cool is this?
It's big.
It's been a long time, and innovation is alive and well at Adobe. And you know, you talk about so many different things that I'm sure we'll touch on. What's happening with creativity,
right,
and everybody still wanting to use different media types and devices to communicate their ideas. What's happening with you know, people trying to power digital businesses, you know, and the metaverse. And so there is just so much that's happening in tech. I think the sentiment has changed a little bit where, you know, if the sentiment was all about these explosive tech businesses that were not necessarily profitable.
Right.
And I think it's changed a little bit to be, you know,
positive longer term.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
Exactly.
Well, look, tomorrow the CPI comes out. And I used to care passionately about the CPI. But when I break out the components, it's not very realistic. What seems realistic is the Adobe Digital Price Index, because that's how people shop. And I've noticed some good trends that I wish the Federal Reserve would look at. And I'm going to give you the floor because I just got the new news right here. Did you not?
Well, you know, I think what people don't recognize is, first, the fact that digital wasn't part of the consumer price index. I mean, it's really crazy to think about how, you know, we were just measuring traditional as opposed to, you know, modern ways of people engaging and doing commerce. I think if you look at the data, you have to really parse it and say what's happening macro economic situation and what's happening as it relates to the secular trend in digital. And we spent $1 billion more in digital than we did just the previous month. And so
the month.
So nothing's going to change as it relates to people saying, I want to do digital engagement. I want to perhaps buy digitally, pick up physically, and, you know, the multi-channel thing. And then you have to look at it and say, what's happening category by category? And I think, you know, when you look at the total expense, in addition to the macroeconomic, where there may be a little bit more concern, what's happened is actually you're seeing some price decreases in elements like electronics or things that are happening with games. Groceries is a little bit still where inflation is doing it. But if you put that together still, that trend is just, you know, going to continue.
Deflationary. The Fed has to be thinking about this, maybe because your index is so exacting and breaks down so much better than CPI, by the way. It is so much more rigorous, let's hope. Now, another deflationary aspect, but that's somebody think about it. Today's the first day that Facebook is not Facebook. It's Meta. And I know that you're in partnership with Meta, and I am such a huge believer in the metaverse. And will you please help me? A lot of people think that I've drunk some sort of Kool-Aid. I think I've come up with a deflationary way to shop and learn.
Well, I think you have to differentiate between what the terms are being used.
Okay.
And, you know, are people going to do more things virtually that they previously did physically? And that's inevitable. And so, you know, whether it's called the metaverse, whether it's called virtual environments, the reality is that, you know, more and more things that were done physical world, we're going to all engage in virtually. And I think gaming was a really great example of what happened, where, you know, when you talk about multiplayer games and the world that's happened, it's clearly exploded.
Right.
And I think the same thing will happen. If you're a small and medium business today, you have to have a physical presence in one of these virtual worlds. If you're trying to do travel or entertainment or education, you have to look at the potential of what you can do with 3D worlds. And I think Adobe's role is really saying it's hard creating those environments. And where we are innovating a lot with Meta and with other companies is saying if you're a large company, you better have a brand there, and you better start to explore. If you're Coke or if you're, you know, a company like Nike, what is your physical presence in these worlds? And if you're a small and medium business, how can you do commerce? And the commerce experience is also going to be far more compelling in the metaverse. And so, you know, I think people may be caught up a little bit by what that term is, but the relentless move towards doing things virtually is not going to change.
Well, one of the things you taught me is look at the eighth graders. What are they going to do? Look at the 10th graders. They are going to be more comfortable in the metaverse than they are going to be in a traditional mall. And we've got to, it's like Bob Dylan, but it's, you know, the times are changing.
Yeah.
And someone like me has to realize that my view is not as relevant as it used to be versus the eighth graders, versus the 22-year-olds who are thinking about starting a business. They know Adobe. They know they can do a business with Adobe. And it's a remarkable thing. And I sometimes wish that our viewers understood that the way people create is on Adobe. But I'm lucky to have kids who do it.
It doesn't matter what industry you're in today, Jim. I was with a CEO of a major automotive manufacturer this morning. And he was talking about what it's going to take to attract that next generation of customers. And everything starts with a phone, and everything's going to be digital. So even in automotive, when you talk about the electrification of cars and you talk about the customer engagement. So I think to your point, the eighth graders are going to wake up saying, if everything's not digital and if I'm not going to engage with that and create with that and learn from that, I'm just going to be behind. So it's amazing. And you see these kids and they just pick it up without any preconceived notions.
Well, then how does someone as great, how do the people at Home Depot, and I've known them and I think they're fabulous, understand they need to ally with you to get to the next level?
I think Adobe really pioneered what we are calling customer experience management. Right. And, you know, supply chain was automated, finance was automated. Nobody had said, why aren't you bringing technology to bear in the area of marketing? And I think that's what Adobe pioneered. And so in many ways, what Home Depot is saying is, we're seeing this confluence of the physical world and the virtual world. But we have to have this customer data platform that allows us to really engage with every customer in a personalized way. So we're thrilled to be working with Home Depot, with Nike, with Verizon, and with all the financial institutions to make that a reality.
Well, look, you make our lives easier because we all are on the go. We don't necessarily want to go to the Big Orange as much as I like their places. And you're the one who's the enabler. I want people to know that that's what Adobe is, the enabler of the next generation of e-commerce, as you always are. I want to thank Shantanu Narayen. He's the chairman and CEO of Adobe. You know, I've liked him. $66 was where I got on board. I wish I had done $35, but you did that switch, and I didn't really understand it until you explained it to me. Man, let me back into the break.
Coming up, should this stock give you some fuel for thought? Kramer hails a sit-down with the Uber CEO next.
1 in 8. That's how many people have worked at a McDonald's. We'll serve millions the best Big Mac and best birthday party they've ever had. Who haven't just seen kids graduate from a Happy Meal, but have gotten help graduating themselves. Because they know the skills learned here.
Bienvenidos. Welcome to English Under the Arches.
Can help you grow from here or keep growing here.
Hi, welcome to
1 in 8 start at McDonald's. And where you start stays with you.
The spirit of performance defines Acura, and now it's electric. Introducing the all-electric ZDX, Acura's most powerful SUV yet. While what powers their cars may change, the energy that makes Acura never will. Crafted using the same formula that brought them electrified supercars and multiple IMSA championships, the ZDX has track-tested performance that packs an energy all its own. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system and up to 313-mile range on a single charge and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is everything they said electric could never be. It was built with the driver in mind, just like Acura has been doing since the beginning. We could talk all day, but the only way to experience this electric performance is to drive it yourself. Unlock the energy and order yours at Acura.com.
Recession fears loom, and Pain at the Pump is flashing a yellow light from Main Street to Wall Street. Is it time to hitch a ride with this stock, or should investors get off the road?
It's been a brutal period to own the ride-sharing stocks, Uber down 60% from its highs last year, because Wall Street has no patience for companies with no earnings, even if they have good cash flow. But a funny thing happened last month. While Lyft reported a truly ugly quarter, Uber turned in a much better set of numbers the next day. More important, management said they plan to significantly cut spending while aiming for more free cash flow, which you know we like, because Wall Street does want to see it. Just yesterday, Barclays published a report where they argued that Uber could benefit massively from recession because it would relieve the driver shortage, and it would also make it impossible for small rivals to raise money. Hey, maybe it's game, set, match. I think it's a very intriguing thesis. So let's check in with Dara Khosrowshahi. And Dara's the CEO of Uber to get a better sense of where his company's headed. Dara, welcome back to Mad Money. It's been too
long. Thank you. It's been a long time. It's great to be here.
And you look good, and I'm thrilled.
Thank you.
So I ride, you know, I take my Uber last night because I don't know anything other than take Uber.
Thank you.
And I say, you know what? Dara won. I'm going to tell Dara that he won. But you know what? Winning these days, even in your excellent note, Dara, which you wrote, and I know all people talked about was like, you know, with freeze or whatever, you talk about winning. And I'm just not sure what winning is in a market where you also say that you have to entrust The shareholders and trust you. And the shareholders, you think, want you to cut back. I don't know. Tell me what to do as a business person. What are you saying? What are you thinking?
Well, it's a complicated world, and there's a lot of uncertainty out there. And I think that you can't win if you're one-dimensional. And what we see, we think investors want is strong top-line growth, right, at the same time strong and expanding profit margins and free cash flow growth. And that's essentially what we think we can deliver. When you look at our last quarter, top line grew by 39%. Our adjusted EBITDA improved by over $500 million. We guided to even improved EBITDA of $240 to $270 million. And we have very clearly said that we are going to be free cash flow profitable this year. And I think that we can continue to deliver really strong top line growth. We set targets of 2024. Top line growth, gross bookings, 22 to 25%, a $5 billion EBITDA target. And we've said generally free cash flow will trail EBITDA by $1 billion, which would suggest free cash flow of almost $2 a share if we hit those 2024 targets.
Okay.
We think that'll be a win.
Now, I think you can do it. But then I come back and say, what were these great projects that you might have had? Did you have other things in mind? Or is the goal just to say, OK, we've got to do this now. Wall Street says we have to do it. Because I know you as a big think guy. And if you decide, listen, I'm going to own trucking, you could own trucking. But maybe that costs too much right now. Maybe the market's just not letting you do some really creative things.
Well, I think the good news for us is we have so many growth drivers that we're able to pull back on the margin, but we can keep pushing on the strategy. So we will pull back on the marginal marketing dollar that doesn't quite have the return that we might wanted, or an incentive dollar. We're going to be tougher in terms of headcount growth. Now, are we going to grow our U4B sales headcount? Absolutely. Are we going to keep growing our sales headcount at Uber Freight, which is growing at really high rate?
Which I love.
Absolutely. But we're going to be more careful in terms of where we invest. And because we're the global player, we're the scale player, and we're diversified, we can have both durable top line and bottom line growth.
I know you can, and I agree with all that. But let me tell you, devil's advocate.
Sure.
I asked my team today, I said, does anyone know about this Uber One? The younger people say, yeah, of course I'm an Uber One. I'm not an Uber One. Why? I am in an Uber every day. I didn't know you had Uber One. I mean, now we got to, you know, that's just now that I know it, I'm signing up. But I mean, that's not how it should be taught. I mean, we should all hear about it.
Well, I do think that that's something I'll take to the Uber One crew generally. Remember, the Uber One is, we're pretty young in terms of the launch of Uber One. And the magic of Uber One is it gives you benefits in terms of delivery. It's similarly priced as our delivery competition. But you get 5% off rides, which, you know, are more expensive. That 5% can save you a lot of money. And really what we're doing is we get people to use Uber, we get people to use Uber Eats, and then we upsell Uber One from Uber and Uber Eats as well. So we will get to you, Jim, one of these days.
All right, now,
I'll make sure we do.
You already got there. How much of your game is a waiting game in that we will have cars with no drivers, and I can imagine that the margins there would be extraordinary for you?
Well, I do think that when we think about driverless, we're very much excited about the future. And really, the way I think about it, Jim, is any driver who's safe in a vehicle, who's a great driver, who provides a great customer service, we want them in our network.
Right.
And whether they're a human driver or a taxi cab or a driverless driver, and we want them on our network both in rideshare, in delivery, and in trucking as well. So you might have seen, actually, the announcement that we made with Waymo via,
yes, that's
which is building driverless trucks. And it's a deep technical integration. A buyer of a Waymo truck essentially will have the software to be able to, in an integrated way, get that truck onto the Uber Freight brokerage network to be able to realize value and money right away. We think those are the kinds of win-win-wins that we see as it relates to self-driving.
I studied that industry. That may be your most lucrative if you get it done. Now, the goalpost did move. You didn't talk about whether it was fair or not, which I really like, because it's irrelevant.
It's a reality.
But at the same time, you didn't get in to be a cutter. You didn't get in to be able to make it so young, great ideas don't get magic. Can it be fun for you? You can do whatever you want in life. Why do this?
Well, we do it because of the impact that Uber is having on the world. Right, is we have 4.5 million earners earning on the platform. And for perspective, Jim, just this year, we've added 1 million new drivers onto our platform. The scale in which we operate and how important we are, you were talking about getting to the hotel and right. making your life a little bit easier in terms of anywhere you want to go in your city, anything you want to get in your city, and then empowering local merchants to be able to have that relationship with you is powerful.
Well, to me, you have gone, a lot of people, you know, the pandemic, not me, those things mean nothing to me. What I know is that if your driver costs would come down, a recession would do that, your margins would expand, and you might be the ultimate stock in a slowdown because people still want to do things. We know that. The consumer has money. I mean, do you think about that, that the raising, the increase in supply of drivers is a great thing for you?
We do think about that. Obviously, we're not rooting for a recession, right? The business is growing at really high rates right now. We're growing top line and bottom line. And I think what makes Uber different is that we're a truly durable company. We have mobility. So when markets reopen, the mobility business is absolutely booming, as we're seeing now. We have delivery. If it closes down, the delivery business booms as well. So we're an all-weather company in those aspects. And you're absolutely right in that we are recession resistant, in that we don't have big fixed costs, and our cost of supply essentially adjusts up and down. In good economies, cost of supply goes up as it is now, and that's great because driver earnings are elevated. In more poor economies, driver earnings come down, but the alternatives are not as plentiful as well, and fast, flexible work opportunities are welcome.
But things are coming back. I mean, you're starting to get some big lift in some cities. The coast doing well, right? The
business is booming. We talked about actually May gross bookings and trips being higher than April, which was already strong. The delivery business is staying strong. And more drivers are coming into our platform than ever. We talked about April, number of new driver sign-ups was up 120%. In May, it's up 145% on a year-on-year basis. Earnings are elevated, and drivers are speaking with their feet on the pedal.
Well,
so
it should matter, but we have a terrible market, but will matter one day. Now, you bought Drizly, $1.1 billion. Therefore, you literally own the market for delivery of liquor because it's too hard. I know these laws. It's really amazing. What's been the return on Drizly?
The return has been very strong. Right. That team, they are the number one player in terms of being a pure play alcohol delivered to your home.
Right.
We're looking at categories, fast and frequent, food, grocery, alcohol, pharmacy. Alcohol is really high margin.
Right.
And I think in this market, margins are even more important. The advertising business in alcohol is huge, and the stickiness that we see. And by the way, you were talking about Uber One. You get discounts on your Drizly orders if you're an Uber One member, Jeff.
Oh, I know what I have to do. Now, speaking of return on investment, let's talk about return on real investment, what you're doing with Ukraine.
Yes.
This is real investment. You and I both know that. I want you to tell people what you decide. This is today's news, and I think it gets more momentum going if you tell people what you're up to.
Absolutely. So this is actually an idea that came from our teams, engineers, et cetera. And we've been working with the UN food program, and the UN food program needs to get food out in Ukraine, but doesn't want to in like big trucks, et cetera, that can be easily targeted. So they want to get the food out in cars, vans, et cetera. And the amazing idea that our teams had is, why don't we build essentially a private label Uber for the UN World Food Program? And so they essentially onboard their own vehicles. They have all the access to the dispatch. They can see when vehicles are showing up. They use a PIN system to identify the right vehicles, and they are getting tons of food out in and expanding, hopefully, into five
cities
in Ukraine.
Clever way to save lives. Sometimes you have to be clever.
It's about impact, Jim. We want to have impact on the world.
Well, you're doing it. Okay, that's Dara Khosrowshahi. And Dara is the CEO, of course, is Uber. Small introduction because everybody knows Dara. Mad Money's back in for break. Thank you, sir.
Thank you so much.
Coming up, among the junk turned to Splunk. Does a recent revenue rally mean this company's bucking the sector's sour trends? Find out next.
You know, I'm aware of these unprofitable software stories in this environment, but just because they're tough to own now, doesn't mean they won't be tough to own forever. Take Splunk, the data analytics and cybersecurity software company that recently brought in a new CEO, Gary Steele, formerly of Proofpoint. We always loved Gary and we loved Proofpoint. That was sold to a private equity firm last year. Now, this one, has been hammered since the peak last November. But 2 weeks ago, Splunk reported a clean beat and raise quarter. Since then, the stock's up a quick $10 and up more than 20% from its May lows. That said, it's still down nearly $20 from where it was trading at the end of April. Like I said at the top of the show, that's just the way it's been lately. So could last month's bottom be the real deal? Let's take a closer look with Gary Steele, the new president and CEO of Splunk. Gary, welcome back to Mad Money.
It's great to be here.
It's great to see you in person,
too. Yeah, absolutely.
All right, I'm going to just say it. I know you as a moneymaker. You told me a long time ago, you were on for Proofpoint many, many times. What are the similarities of Splunk and the differences, and how are you trying to remake Splunk? Because you were successful doing cybersecurity at Proofpoint.
Yeah, one of the great similarities is the customers that are being served. So Splunk has an amazing list of Fortune 500 customers. Second is solving the cyber problems in this day and age, super important. And Splunk basically is the underpinning for all of those cyber teams, making it more critical than ever. So I think those are really great elements. And the thing I'm excited about is to bring a different point of view potentially to what the financials look like. Splunk has incredible opportunity for long-term durable growth, but I think we can also improve our profitability over time.
Okay,
and create some balance there.
Well, Doug Merritt, and I know he left the company, but he was on multiple times. Traced out a vision where you had to go to a different model, and he was not able to complete the model when we were there. Are you there now, and is it more lucrative than the way it used to be run?
I think the transition, we're vastly through the transition. And that transition is simple. We went from an on-premise environment to a cloud environment. And with that, we changed our revenue model from being a perpetual license model to being subscription. So that's a normal transition. And that confused some people.
Predictable and lovable. You know that's how we do.
And you just have to get to the other side, which is we're vastly there. And so if you look at the business today, in the most recent quarter, 57% of our business was cloud. Okay. And so we're really getting through that process, and it really shows up in the strength in the financials today.
Okay. Now, here's a phrase that I need to understand. Observability becomes essential. What does that mean if you're a shareholder of Splunk? How is that going to help the company?
You know, it's really interesting. Observability is a category of infrastructure where you give insights and visibility to what your applications are doing. And one of the things we found is that if an application goes down that's serving a customer, you immediately need to know, is that a security event or did the application fail? And so you need to be able to respond quickly and either bring the application up or respond to a security event. And these markets have really converged. And so what we've seen is while our strength started in security, we're really extending that strength, helping organizations run mission critical applications that ultimately drive resilience in the business.
Now, there are other companies in that. And
definitely.
I have to believe that, let's say, Microsoft, which we used to talk about all the time when you're proof
point,
that Microsoft can say, you know what? I want to do exactly what these guys do. I can wipe out Splunk. It doesn't happen, though.
No, Splunk has some incredibly important differentiators technically. And some of those just mean that you can get access to data wherever it resides to make business critical decisions. You can see across your entire environment with visibility, and you can make sure that all those applications are staying up and running and serving your customers.
Now, we were talking earlier with Dara from Uber. And one of the things that I found interesting was that he talked about how the goalposts have changed. I mean, even in the time since you've taken over Splunk, mm-hmm. We want you to make money now. But before, we wanted you to land, expand, take business. I mean, what do you do? I mean, you were fortunate enough in that you had this gap year, basically. But this new way of running a company is not necessarily a way to make the company the best.
No, but I think I've always believed in a balanced approach.
Okay.
And I think Splunk has a unique opportunity with long-term durable growth because of the value that we're delivering to customers, to combine that with increasing cash flows and operating margins over time. And I think that balance, I think it has value in good times and bad times and whatever's in favor. I think that balanced approach is really important.
Okay, can you give us a little preview about .conf 22? Because I believe that there's going to be thousands of Splunk customers there, and I want to know what they might be hearing.
You bet. So we're headed to .conf. That is our annual user conference. Okay. I'm super excited to be there to spend time with all of our customers and all the passion that they have around Splunk and all of our Splunkers who are Splunk employees. So super excited about that. We've got some exciting product announcements, some great partner announcements. And really good. And I think it just speaks to the momentum that the business has right now. So super excited to be participating in that.
Is this the first time everyone's getting together?
since the pandemic. So we'll have over 5,000 people in person, and then we're going to be streaming live to more than 10,000. So the numbers are big.
All right, so one question. We learned how to live in the pandemic.
We did.
Do we like the new world where we're back?
I think we like the new world where we're back. I'm excited to be back.
Okay, because a lot of people say, you know, I miss the old world if he's making me come back to work 5 days a week, but you're not, right?
We're not. We're allowing our employees flexibility because I think we've all learned to work differently, and we're embracing that.
Excellent. I knew you would.
All right. Awesome.
Once again, thank you for all the money you made for shareholders. You just came one again over and over again, no matter what, and it was just really great, great investment. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's Gary Steele, the new president and CEO of Splunk, a stock we've liked a lot. But remember, when we talk about Gary, we talk about all the money we made in Proofpoint. Everybody's back after the break.
Thank you so much.
Stick around.
May I make a suggestion? I would stay with Kramer.
The lightning round is coming up next.
And then the lighting runs over. Are you ready? Keep that light records runs over with Ryan, Illinois. Ryan.
Jim, how's it going?
Couldn't be better. How about you, Ryan?
Good. Hey, I'm wondering about this company that I love for years, if it's the next big fast food chain. Started in my home state of Illinois in 1963, became publicly traded in October of last year. They're expanding outside of the Midwest. Amazing food. The place is always packed. The company is Portillo's, P-T-L-O.
Okay, look, I absolutely know the story, and the story is a great one. That is a terrible business right now. We're going to have to save that one for later and lower. Tony in Ohio. Tony!
Hi, Jim. I'm in Cincinnati. Boom!
Holy cow. That is, I'll tell Sarah. Sarah Eisen, I think she would live there at some point. Let's go.
Okay, this is, you get a great investor when you buy this stock. Its 52-week high was $362. It closed today at $300.80. BRKB.
Do you know that I've been recommending that stock ever since the week that the show began, and it's been right the whole way, and I reiterate that Berkshire Hathaway is for me. Lou in Florida. Lou!
How you doing tonight, Jim? Thanks for taking my call.
Oh, you're welcome.
I've been trying a few days. You're harder to reach than the White House.
Well, you know, I hang up on a lot of people, too. No, those are just those ones. They want to get some warranty or something. Will you tell them to stop calling me? What's up?
That's hysterical. Listen, I've been holding on to Anheuser-Busch for quite a while, and it's been going south since I bought it. I know the market's not real good now, but did people stop drinking beer?
The numbers go up in beer. I've done a lot of work on this. It's actually the right thing, but I do prefer Constellation. They are a share taker from Anheuser-Busch, but you are dead right. Beer sales go up. I've studied this for about 60 years, and you're right to stick with that idea. Let's go to Richard in Georgia. Richard!
Jimmy Chill, booyah, from Atlanta, home of the world champion Atlanta Braves.
True, very true. I let someone down the other day ask me about what do you think about Atlanta. I left the Braves out. I was talking about the Falcons. My mistake. What's up?
Hey, focusing on energy and yields, I've got a company that operates about 50,000 miles of natural gas liquid, crude oil, and other petrochemical pipelines. They have a 6.5% yield. And in the first quarter, generated record distributable cash flow of about $1.8 billion, which provided almost twice the coverage of its quarterly distribution. That stock is Enterprise Products Partners.
I love that company. I love that company.
I think it's an amazing company.
I wish they'd come on air. They are so well run. It is terrific. Continue to buy that one. Buy a lot of it. Let's go to Steve in New Jersey. Steve.
Hey, Jim. How are you doing tonight?
I am doing well, Steve. How about you?
Okay, here's what I have. The company I'm calling about should do well in the coming months. Also, two directors recently made large buys. Can you tell me your opinion of Six Flags Entertainment?
We are in an unusual time where I just feel that if you get bad weather like we had for Scott's Miracle-Gro for a month, you're going to end up getting hurt. So I'm going to have to say no to Six Flags. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is the conclusion of the Lightning Round!
The Lightning Round is sponsored by TD Ameritrade. Coming up, a whole new meaning to the term left coast. Kramer takes on the impact of an upcoming Golden State exile. Next.
but it happens to be great news for the rest of the country. We're about to experience a California diaspora, the likes of which we haven't seen since the dot-com bomb went off. Might be even bigger. That's right, companies are making plans to leave the region, or at least putting up new facilities in what seems like anywhere about a 60-mile circumference around San Francisco. It's the reverse of the Grapes of Wrath, a backwards Dust Bowl, and it's going to play off in all sorts of different ways that nobody's thinking about. Now, you might think all I do when I'm out here is interview a bunch of executives, then head back to the hotel room for a couple hours of sleep for the next show. No. What I really love out here in San Francisco, and what I missed terribly during the pandemic, is the ability to pull up with some of the biggest and the best, not on the air, but off the air, and really find out what's going on. Let me tell you what they're talking about. First, I never thought I'd hear this again, but there will be a round of layoffs in Silicon Valley that could rival the Post.com layoffs in 2001. Yes, business for many of these companies is weak. Not just freeze week, but fire week. Just today, we learned that Citrix letting go 15% of its salaried employees. Do you know that company is a company that used to pride itself on profitability? It's happening to every tech company that's involved with the consumer, every enterprise software play where the end markets are softer. So brace yourself for the inevitable. After years where smaller tech companies only worried about revenue growth, there's now a definitive sense that unless a business starts making money, I mean real, non-adjusted free cash flow, then their stocks will collapse and it'll be difficult to attract new talent. Remember, the industry loves to pay people with stock options, but that's not an enticing form of compensation when the stocks keep getting pulverized. Winning companies, losing stocks. Second, many of the CEOs out here have had it with younger workers who are telling them what to do, when and where they want to work. They're tired of the San Francisco workforce, which they think is full of spoiled nitwits who are there one day and gone the next to make even more money. So they're moving to areas of the country where they can hire talented people for way less money. People who have more loyalty to the business and accountability to the CEO, if only because they'll have fewer options to jump ship. Now, some of these moves are big. Pat Gelsinger, CEO of Intel, trying to create a Silicon Heartland in Ohio, and it's beginning to bear fruit. He'll soon break ground for a semiconductor manufacturing complex, something we've long neglected in this country. He's harnessing all of the great schools in the area to focus on computer engineering, computer science, study of semiconductors. Coalition of public and private collaborators is like nothing I've ever seen. If Washington can get its act together and pass the CHIPS Act, which would give the chipmakers more than $50 billion to build the infrastructure we need to bring key semiconductor manufacturing back to the U.S., then Intel will have all the help it needs and then some. Ohio will become the new hub of tech. Finally, after the success of work from home, some CEOs are moving their headquarters to cheaper environments simply because it doesn't make sense to pay up for office space in this San Francisco metro area when people can work remotely. I heard Atlanta mentioned several times. Austin is always in the mix, and of course, Florida. Why bother to be in the most expensive state in the country when you can be in one of the cheapest? So you now have it early. The tech exodus from California is coming, and with it, lower expense structure and perhaps, and this is Jimmy old school chill speaking, some gratitude for having a job at all. I like to say there's always a bull market somewhere, and I promise to try to find it just for you right here on Mad Money. I'm Jim Cramer. See you tomorrow. The news with Shepard Smith starts now.
At Capella University, you'll get support from people who care about your success. From before you enroll to after you graduate, pursue your goals knowing help is available when you need it. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.